Hey everybody, welcome to a brand new episode of Hey Man, It's Okay, a men's mental health podcast. I'm your host, Sky Bridges, your regular guy who's just here to learn with you guys, who has a passion for mental health, and I'm excited to be here.
Everybody, and I am Ryan Heapy, your licensed psychotherapist. And Sky, we have somebody who sounds like he's pretty special in your life. And why don't you tell us who we got?
Yeah, sure. I'm really excited about today. I feel so honored to have him on the podcast. This is somebody who he's a radio personality here in Seattle, and he's been all over, and he was there to lighten my day when I was having some bad times. Hearing the jokes, hearing the banter between the people, it made me smile every day. I want to welcome to the show BJ Shea. Welcome to the show, BJ.
Thanks for having me, guys. Anytime anybody wants to talk about mental health, especially for us guys, I am in.
Great. That's so exciting because I feel like you have a lot to share since being in the radio industry. I'm sure you started to see more mental health be talked about. So it's really cool that you're here to do that with us.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome that, especially for men, mental health is now coming up in conversation. You've got a lot of luminaries in the world of music and movies and television and sports where men are coming forward and saying, look, man, this is a big part of my life. And I've been able to interact with some of those folks because of my job and a company that I work for, Odyssey, that decided that mental health was something that they wanted to be more a part of. And it started in Seattle. And my boss at the time, Dave Richards, came to me because he knew that I was dealing with some suicide issues in my family. And he knew how important it was to me because I really wanted to get some research. I wanted to help out the people involved in my family so that we could be supportive. And he really thought, hey, I think it's a big issue. Would you like to host a national show for our company based on suicide awareness? And he put together such a fantastic show, guests and professionals and people in the world of suicide awareness prevention, therapists, and then, of course, all the celebrities that they all came together. It's really fascinating, all the walks of life of people, all the genres of music. You mentioned suicide awareness, and they just know, especially in the world of music and any form of entertainment, they were, yes, we want to get the word out. And then men especially were like, we definitely need to get the word out for a lot of our brothers who are in the military and all who just don't think they can talk about it and mental health in general. And so we started that about, I'd say between 5 and 7 years ago. It's now a national production hosted by Carson Daly. And wow. I'm really happy to be a person that was involved in that in my small way back in the day, because I just believe that men are so capable of so much more on the emotional scale. I'm a big Terrence Real fan, and his whole idea about that men just get the short end of the emotional stick just because society says lust and anger, those are the only two you get, the only two emotions you can feel.
Yeah.
I love that. Oh, wait a minute. I was never that kind of person growing up. I'm capable of more, as we all are. So I'm happy to talk about mental health, man. And radio definitely started and has done a good job, especially with my company about 7 years ago when they started the I'm Listening program.
Sky was talking earlier about the impact that it had made on him. And I was just reflecting what an impact radio and kind of Seattle made an impact on my mental health growing up. As far as radio, Loveline was, I don't know if you are familiar. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I went through a ton of pain and challenges and depression when I was really young. And my headphones and my Walkman between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. were truly, it was called Loveline, but it was truly a lifeline for me to just hear other people talk about their struggles. And then also the impact that Seattle music made on like my mental health and the youth that were crying out, the Gen Xers, and just, yeah, what an impact for Sky and I in a totally different generations, and how radio really influenced so much of that.
The Seattle music scene was terrific. Such creative individuals and also super collaborative, which Seattle itself is just in so many ways. We, even in radio, everything, it was just different. People collaborated. They cared about each other. Even if we were in competition, that surely happened in the music scene as bands and singers were just jumping all over everybody else's stuff and saying, sure. And Loveline also was such an amazing program because of how it just brought that subject down to the regular person, made it entertaining. You had a great balance with Adam and Dr. Drew that it just works so well. And as you said, Ryan, the amount of good work that show did, incidentally, it's like, oh, hey, we're having a good time. We're two guys talking. Dr. Drew is making sure he's doing what he's doing. Adam is just being Adam. And it made it so accessible for a person like you to get, hey, good stuff. This is helping me. And it's a language that it's being spoken to me. They're so much more receptive and there's so much more out there. But sometimes the languaging that women have with each other just doesn't hit the average guy, no matter how good the message is. And Loveline was such a great way to take that great message and put it in the right language.
I remember staying up late at night in my room listening to Loveline until I fell asleep to it. I'd always set a timer on my radio because I'd always fall asleep. But yeah, you're right. It was really cool to hear two guys talk about mental health from two different perspectives. Hey, that kind of works, doesn't it, Ryan?
It sure does. That's cool. We talked about this a few episodes ago of just hoping to make some sort of impact and having people maybe relate to us as well. But BJ, what was that time like where Seattle was exploding and you must have been on the forefront?
I have to say, I got here in 1999. So the Seattle Sound had already been established. And one of my co-hosts, Steve Miggs, moved from New York to Seattle right around that time because he was listening to the music, loved the music. So he wanted to be here for the music. I was such a spoken word person. I would just go where anybody would put me. And I grew up listening to great spoken word radio, but they were on rock stations. You had these fantastic talk shows that weren't like conservative talk shows. They were entertainment. And every town seemed to have a Bob Rivers. And in my town, there was a guy named Charles Lacordaire. He's who I grew up listening to. And he was counterculture in the 70s. And so everything that was just like the Vietnam War or whatever, this guy's on an FM radio station, which at the time FM wasn't as popular as AM radio. But I grew up on that. And it was our huge show in the 70s. And that was my age of discovery. The music wasn't as important as the message of the jock, the rock, the guy that was on there just with all of his crazy characters. But it was like the rebellious side. And it had a flavor of like hippies with an edge because Boston is, I always tell everybody, Bostonians are like real life Klingons from Star Trek. We are the most aggressive out of everybody in America. Even New Yorkers think Bostonians are rude. And so there was that edge that came even with a hippie movement. When the hippie movement had that influence in Boston, there still was this bit of an aggressive hippie movement. And that was what Charles's show was like. It was clever. It was aggressive. It was stand up against the man. It was funny. And so he used a lot of humor. And that's what I looked at. I remember being 15 years old and saying, I want to do that. And Of course, everybody's like, oh, yeah, you're going to go be on the radio working at a station Charles was on at this radio station in Boston, which was the big rock station in Boston. And eventually I did get to do that at the big rock station in Seattle 25 years, 30 years later. And it was the station that was at the forefront of the Seattle sound. And we on a regular basis would have guys from Pearl Jam come in and guys, Duff McKagan, of course, Guns N' Roses, an LA-ish band. Duff is a Seattle kid. And so we would have a great relationship with those luminaries as they go, we got a new album out. We're gonna come on and talk about it. Or, hey, we want to come in and do an acoustic thing. And that was just so nuts to be in that scene. But those guys, their music had the same passion and the same idea that my spoken word presentations were all about. And when we got to meet each other, it was evident. You could just see, oh, okay, you're the heart of an artist, I'm the heart of an artist. That every time I met people from a lot of those bands in Seattle, you just got that they just had the hearts of an artist. I forget, was it Stone Gossard that was like, yeah, I don't care about the awards. He says, yeah, I think my Grammy's a doorstop somewhere. He doesn't know if it's downstairs. they were just so much about the art and about the message, about making the world a better place. And that's what I always loved to do with my show. And eventually, mental health started getting in there. I found that out because I interacted with a lot of celebrities in the world of movies and television. And any celebrity in that world, in the movie world, the television world, the successful ones that were kind, what I found is that they had done therapy. It's really
interesting.
You can seek fame and fortune. Now, granted, it's anecdotal, Sky.
Sure.
You can seek fame and fortune, but a lot of celebrities, they'll be like, we do the art first, and then the fame and fortune may come. Hopefully it does, but we want to put art first. And they found doing therapy really helped them do better art. And that was the consistent anecdotal message that I would get every time I interacted with a celebrity. And if I was lucky enough to have a conversation with them, if they came in on the show and guested on the show, I would pick their brain a little bit because I love that world. And that's what I found. A lot of them were like, hey, man, I'm in therapy. And if you share you're in therapy, somehow somebody else is so happy to tell you, hey, I am too. It's this wonderful brother and sisterhood in the world of entertainment. And that helped me realize how important that would be in my life is to get on that road. Because I wasn't always in therapy when I was in entertainment. It took a while before I got in.
It's interesting. It was like Charlemagne the God actually was one of the more instrumental figures in really breaking the stigma over the last decade. He had a whole book going to
Yeah, Charlemagne is one of the shining stars and amazing success stories of our business. His success and what he's done is just amazing. And yeah, to your point, Ryan, again, it didn't surprise me when I found that out about Charlemagne. It didn't surprise me because he's just so good. So of course you're that good. You've really done self-inquiry, self-realization. Makes sense.
Yeah. What do you think it is that the celebrities or people who've achieved fame, that they're getting out of therapy? Do you think it's like a humility check? Do you think it's maybe bringing them back down to earth or having somebody hopefully who's not maybe influenced by their fame or trying to get anything out of them, and maybe the one voice that can actually give them some truth and challenge them a bit?
I can speak to me as far as an artist, what do I get out of it? But I would think you'd get similar answers. If you want to be believable, if you want to be authentic, for me, I've always said I want to be the Meryl Streep of broadcasting, because Meryl makes you believe that she is who she is on the screen. And yet she's been so many different people and it's not real, but you watch on the screen and she's, oh, I'm going to make you believe this. And therapy, I believe, helps me get to that authentic place. If I can be real with me, if I can be totally honest with all of my motivations in any given moment. And frankly, I think the toughest thing for me was to realize that I was the villain of probably almost every story that I was in, whereas everybody was the villain of whatever story I had, everybody else was the villain. That part of therapy that has me look for my accountability, that authenticity, going to that core place makes me at that real truthful place. Then I can then from there act from and be an artist from. And until I'm courageous enough to go to that place, which therapy can help me get there, I don't know if I'm going to be as good of a performer. And I think that's probably what a lot of these actors and performers realize is that, whoa, I'm going to get to this place of truth. And from that truth place, I will be the best performer that I could ever be before I went to that truth place. That's what I believe. At least for me, that's how it is. And I feel like that's when I have these wonderful conversations with people in therapy who are artists, that's really what it is. They're just wanting to show up without any delusion. They want to show up without any cognitive distortion. They just want to be able to see what's going on, especially with them, because you can't really ever know what's going on with another person. You can try to think, but I just don't think I'll ever be able to figure out what's going on with somebody else. But the best shot I have is to figure out what's going on with me. And from that place, I can do my best work. If I actually go, I think I know what's going on with me. I think I know what's happening right now. That helps me when stuff comes my way. And in the world of improv entertainment, which is my favorite kind of entertainment, it's so important to be able to be that open, that aware, so that I can respond. It's hard to do that when I'm clouded, when I don't know what's real, when I don't know what's true, when my thoughts want to tell me stories and I don't question them. That's when I don't think I'm at my best as a human or as a performer. And I think a lot of actors that get to that level get that. Not every actor does. You still can be successful. You can be a successful human being in so many different ways by the way we define success and be completely mentally unhealthy. That's something I didn't realize. You can be a mess, pardon the official terms, but you can be a mess and still be very successful.
Sure.
And I love that I figured that out so that I really want to be clear. I just want to be clear so that I can know the truth of what's happening with me. I think that helps me love humans better. It helps me relate to people better if I can be clear with myself.
That's awesome. Something, as you were talking, I was thinking about something I love about the Seattle music scene, and I'm sure you saw this too, is I have a couple of friends who are really involved in the Seattle music scene, are part of the Seattle music scene, and people who are connected to it. And all of the like super nice, friendly guys I know, they're all in therapy. And it's so cool because I feel like we have an advantage here in Seattle. We are like really accepting and really at a forefront of mental health, I feel like. And seeing that happen, it has just been really cool to see these big, tough guys that are like, I cry with my therapist. Like, I know I have a really good friend who was a big Seattle guy, and I've made him cry more than once. It's the best. I love it.
It's a beautiful thing, man. It really is, to be able to get in touch with those emotions. And more stuff is coming out. I love that. I really am steeped in behavioral sciences. I went all in. I thought, okay, if I'm going to do this, and I started doing it, and I came across a letter that my kids gave me when it was about 20, 25 years ago, where I was just, my thing is that I am a verbally abusive rager. And so it was one of my sessions, one of my episodes where I was angry at the family, angry at them. And I was in my room just seething. And then this note was slipped under a door. And my two kids, they may have been, I don't know, 11 and 8 years old. They wrote me a letter, and they started the letter off apologizing for their rude behavior. And this has so many spelling errors. They might even been younger than that, because the spelling errors were just. But then they had a list of demands, and they about how I should be. And it was even, I just read it today. It was so humbling about, we don't want to be called names, and you should really appreciate how good your life is. Remember what it was like to be a child, like all of this information. And they probably were prompted by their mom a little bit, but that's still, I'm reading this letter, and I'm reading it today, and I showed it to my daughter, who's now about to have her own child. And I said, hey, look what I found. And it was powerful, but that's what inspired me. I said, okay, look at these kids. They are much more centered than I am. They're much more mature than I am. I just screamed at them. And yet this letter is still very kind, and they're assertive, but they're not abusive. And I'm like, whoa, I have to be better than this now. They deserve better. And that's what got me started into therapy. And I just never looked back. I realized, oh my gosh, there's so much great material, and the behavioral sciences are so fantastic. In the East, you're praised for looking at yourself, being a yogi, hiking up to the mountain to talk to the big yogi in the cave. It's the same thing. We've been looking at the human mind for so long, and thought management for so long, that that's what it is. But in our culture, for whatever reason, I think it's probably because humans are easy to manipulate if they're not empowered. So some people who are mentally unhealthy think, oh, this is great for my profit-making business, or great so that I'll be kept safe. And so disempowering humanity has always been the thing that's happened. And the behavioral sciences have always been there to help against that, or to also help to make that happen as well, because a lot of people are smart and see how humans tick and take advantage of that as well. And I really had said, okay, I want to be a student of this. I want to know everything as much as possible because I love this knowledge. I want to be clear. And I think it's the single greatest discovery humans have ever made is behavioral sciences. I know we've had a lot of great discoveries, but I think the behavioral sciences may be the best thing humans have ever done.
Is there one that's your favorite?
I've always been a fan of cognitive behavioral therapy. There's a simple one that I just love her story because she's just a basic person from Barstow, California, who had, I don't know, maybe a nervous breakdown or whatever you might want to call it, a mental break. And in that mental break came up with a pretty amazing cognitive behavioral process. Her name is Byron Katie. And she's just mystified people in the behavioral sciences because she's never had any training, but she comes come up with this simple four-step process that she had happen when she basically had this mental break where it puts you in a really cool cognitive behavioral state that allows you to view all sides, to get out of what you think is the only viewpoint possible. And all of these professionals are like, you've never gone to school? And it was so concise. They're like, wow. And it's so down to earth. Like, you get to be vindictive and mean and petty, which usually that doesn't happen in the new age, new thought world, or people always want to have positive affirmations. And she's got this list where you get to judge your neighbor. First thing you get to do is go, I hate this person because blah, 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 blah. And like, you would never think you would be starting a process that would actually put you in a great cognitive behavioral state and of examination. But that's exactly what it does. And then it goes all the way through to next thing you know, you're turning around this whole process and looking at yourself with the same sort of set of examinations. Okay, maybe I'm this person or maybe I'm that guy. And she just simply came up with it. And that's one that's really latched on to me. I have been exploring internal family systems. I love the idea of parts of me that may seem like they're the enemy, but actually are doing they're doing good work for me. And I just have to find out what they think they're doing. And that's a fun thing.
That's so funny. Ryan just brought up internal family therapy with me last week.
Yeah. Yeah. I just started reading Richard Schwartz's book, and I didn't know, somebody suggested it to me because I've always called these voices in my head my committee. And so I'm like, I remind myself I'm the CEO, and I sit down and say, okay, guys, you're saying a lot to me. I need more. I demand more information from my committee before I will make a decision. And somebody had said to me, one of my therapists said, it sounds like you're doing IFS work. I'm like, I don't even know what that is. Just tell me more. So I really like that. The latest book I'm reading is called The Anxious Generation. And it's really like the idea of how a certain kind of parenting, as well as smartphone technology and social media, how that's affected what he calls the great rewiring of childhood. And that's fascinating the heck out of me, especially with the state our country's in right now. And I'm so fascinated. Oh, I love that there's, but again, I love that the research is out there. And I tell everybody, it's out there. How do I know it's out there? Because people are taking advantage of us with this research. So I know it's out there because, frankly, nobody's that bright in the world of corporate America. Like, I just refuse to believe that. They're just not that bright. If you're getting me to buy a product I really shouldn't want to buy, you didn't come up with that idea. Some behavioral scientist came up with some information that you've twisted a little bit, and now you've got it on its ear. So that means I know the information's out there that can reset me. And so that's exciting when anybody gets upset about, oh, the world's the way it is and the way they treat us. I'm like, oh, no. Somebody found out some information. They gave it a little flip like humans do, but we can flip it right back to where it's supposed to be, which is what's so great about the world of therapy, baby.
Not to go too conspiratorial, but when you look into what the CIA really is all about, I'm just going to throw this number out there. It's probably not accurate, but it sounds like almost 70 to 80% of what they teach or what they focus on is behavioral sciences and how to influence, manipulate other people. It's really fascinating stuff. There's a couple people I follow out there in the podcast world, and so much of their training is psychology. It's like almost exclusively psychology.
Of course. It's a better way to learn to get a leg up in life. But learn how humans be humans. Yes, of course. And yeah, there's, and like anything, again, that's the beauty of human beings. We are creatures that we can be so many different parts of the spectrum of whatever. Cool things that we do, not so cool things that we do. That's just the basic, that's just basically the blueprint of a human being. And I love the fact that we are capable of such horror and capable of such beauty. But nature, the world, everything, the animal kingdom is also the same way. So is when people get mad at other human beings and go, oh, I hate the way humans are, they're so what, they're horrible, they're ruining everything. It's, no, we're like everything else. There's in the animal kingdom too, you'll see some horrific things. But that's just what they do. We do this, but look what we do. We also do some pretty damn amazing, cool things. And where do I want to be? How do I want to exist? Do I want to focus on what I think is the horrible, or do I want to focus on what I think is amazing as far as so that my mood can be in such a state that I can not spiral down a place that will really just not be good for me? I'm not going to ignore tough stuff. And as a group, I will get together with my group, whatever that might be, like America, whatever, and say, look, we're going to come up with some rules and regulations that we all think are cool. And if you break those rules, yeah, you know what? Sorry, this is what's happening. But I'm not going to destroy my life because I am trying to bring someone to justice to the point that I've got so much hate in my heart. And that's tough. When people are victimized, it's hard for them to realize, hey, you can still be just and you can still stand up for what's right and have a great life, too. You can still have a great life, too. That's hard sometimes for some humans that have been had some tough stuff happen to them, and they want to mobilize to stop those tough things from happening to other people.
One of my absolute favorite quotes, which this all reminds me of, is we don't experience life. We experience the life we focus on.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I like that a lot. Yeah.
Can you say that one more time, please?
We don't experience life. We experience the life we focus on. Yeah. We're able to really hold one thought or one idea at a time. And so much of it is fleeting, but really it's that frame or that focus that really shapes, colors, dictates. I like to almost think of them as like Instagram filters of how we're approaching life and which are we, do we have that like Seattle dark mood or the New York brashness or I don't know, the LA superficiality, but yeah, whatever kind of whatever filter we put on. But BJ, how do you think therapy influenced your work? How you maybe decided to approach the world, decided to talk to thousands, if not millions of people over your life?
My work was my therapy for the longest time. I didn't know it. I didn't know that I was using my job as therapy. When I first started in Seattle, I just decided to be truthful. Not so much with myself, but truthful about some of the BS that the world would try to tell me. And it seemed to be a refreshing voice for Seattleites. Women are very active in this town as far as they're in charge of a lot. And more women are registered to vote in Seattle than men. And lots of women in powerful positions, more so than maybe other parts of the country. And, you know, what I always say to anybody, and nowadays it's awful hard when you're a 65-year-old white cisgendered heterosexual man, but it's like people don't really want to hear more from that demographic. And so it's tough for me to point out the flaws of anything because people will just go, oh yeah, you have been the problem for the longest time. And I would fire back in those days when this was 30 years ago or so, I'd fire back and say, look, I get it. There's been men have done bad stuff and women have been overlooked. But you're a human being still. And if you get power, you're going to be susceptible to the garbage that everybody who's in power is susceptible to. So you're not perfect no matter who you are. Women can make mistakes. And men sometimes cannot make mistakes and do good things. But there was a time in Seattle when I was on the air where it was men were really bad guys. And women, oh my God, are victimized every 5 seconds. And therefore, we have to make sure that we overcorrect. And therefore, there was never a time where a woman could do any wrong. And there was, and men were always doing wrong. And I just stood up to that and said, no, look, we have to still be fair. Like the oppressed becomes the oppressor. I've always hated that. It's like the oppressed should become equal, but it never goes that way in human history because right. The oppressed don't ever want to be oppressed again. So they get so scared that they become the oppressor to save for their own safety. And that's where history is always good to look at. It was like the psychological history is, look, man, let's not get there. And, you know, to be fair, in a lot of marginalized communities, if you really listen to some of the leaders, they're not saying they want to be like unequal. It's usually people in those marginalized communities that aren't very wise, that are very angry, haven't done a lot of therapy. Sometimes they're the loudest voices, but they're not the leaders of those communities. If you talk to, if you really listen to the leaders of those communities, they're pretty pragmatic. They're pretty reasonable. They're like, look, the only way we're all going to make it through this world is if we all get along and we're all equal. Not that, oh, hey, because my people were basically treated this way for X amount of years, now we have to treat these people badly. It's, that's not how it works, but that's how some people just, that's how humans sometimes just be because they're afraid. That's what I did. I would just say, sorry, no. And I would do it in my world where I was a husband that just was like, my wife is not always right. She doesn't always know everything. And in some cases, she's really very ignorant. And I would just say that on the air. And you were never supposed to say that as a man about your wife. And so you were just never supposed to say it. It went over well with my target audience because, and my wife never liked it, but I used to say to her, I go, look, I'm working. You're not working. This is making us money. I have good ratings. Let's go. I go. And she said, but a lot of the stories you're telling me about me aren't true. I said, yes, I'm creating a character that has your name. Of course, it's not true, but I'm doing art in order to change, like to change the world. These men are feeling what I'm feeling. They're feeling like they're not valued because they just happen to be men. You don't know anything because I'm the woman and I know more about raising kids than you. And some men would be like, I actually have been doing some reading and I've been seeing some things. And well, as it turns out, the big thing we talked about was participation trophies. And in the anxious generation, he really focuses on the overprotection of children and the helicopter parenting as being one of the main reasons why Generation Z and Generation A are really, they have all these anxiety disorders. They were never allowed to experience failure. They weren't allowed to resolve their own schoolyard issues. All the things you have to do as a human being to learn how to be in real life, we parents, and it was my generation, I did it, we protected them. And so the participation trophy was the thing where I was like, what? No, I don't want your trophy for being average. I stunk. I know I stunk. This will motivate me to get better or go find something I can be better in. I was a horrible athlete. I was so bad. I was always picked last. So I said, I've got to find something where I'm great in. And that's where I turned to board gaming and strategy. And I used my brain because my physical body just was not good enough. But if you gave me a participation trophy and told everybody that they were okay and you were just as good as the guy that was hitting 5 home runs and I was striking out all the time. I saw that happen where kids were being given this false narrative where they really believed they were as good as the star. And I'm like, this is not good because then they're just not going to understand reality. And then when life hits you in the face, when you get older and say, hi, my mom says I'm really good, so you're going to hire me for this job and pay me top dollar. And they're like, no, we're not, because you're not good. And no, you're not getting top dollar. And they're getting wrecked. They're like, oh, my God, I don't know what to do with this. And that is, I think that's on me as a parent because I let that happen. But I would say stuff about that on my show. I would say, this is crazy. I don't think we should do it. But a lot of parents were afraid of letting their kids get hurt for whatever reason. He believes it's because of the advent of cable news where everybody thought the world was more dangerous than it is. And then the parents, oh, my God. And of course, if you're in fear, boy, we can sell you things if you're in fear. Oh, my gosh, can we sell you so many products if you're afraid? So I think corporate America, cable news network, parents afraid just created this situation where kids were stunted from the natural process of going out there and learning how to be strong so that they'd be ready for the adult world. And that means let them go on the playground. Don't get involved. Let them figure their own stuff out, including if they get excluded, including if somebody pushes them down. This book is really powerful in that. And again, it's behavioral science. So it's,
yes,
there are answers out there, baby. And it can be fixed. That's the other thing. It's not, oh, it's too late. We're human beings. We can adapt as long as we face the truth. And you guys know it's tough. It's tough to get the truth out there because so many people are incentivized for us not to be empowered. They don't want us to rely on something, whatever that something might be, or someone or some group. But man, I love mental health and this kind of talk because it will make people actually do what they can do for themselves, put their own oxygen mask on. They'll be cool and they'll be stronger.
Well, do you think this is what we can do as men? Sorry, Ryan.
Go for it.
Oh, do you think this is what we can do as men, is just be there to talk to other men and give them the permission to be vulnerable and to open up and to encourage therapy? What do you see is, how do we start this movement? How do we get more men talking and involved in mental health?
I think with men, I've had a couple of friends of mine that have done some workshops and things. And one thing they always did that I thought was good, and it was, you make it simple. Men right now are just like, give me some tools. What do you got? Like, men don't like to have long conversations usually. And men just want solutions usually. Until things change, where men are brought up in environments where there's more talking, more conversation. Men usually were brought up in environments where it's physical activities, like they did stuff with their dads, they did stuff with their brothers. There wasn't a lot of talk. You were made to feel bad if you were overly talkative. I know for me, I was way overly talkative for the average man. And I was made to feel bad for it. You're not really a man. You're a mama's boy. You're this, you're that. So it wasn't valued that I had good verbal skills. It wasn't valued that I thought the way that I thought. And I think the more we raise our children, and I think we do a good job with girls. I think that with girls, we've shown them that there's more value than just what we said girl values were back in the 50s and 60s and beyond, and earlier than that. So I think women have thrived much better, realizing they can be well-balanced. Men have not been given that same shot. We're still being held in certain stereotypes, even though everybody realizes, oh, we got to be cooler with women and girls. Everybody knows that. But even women are like not so cool to men, and letting them develop their emotional strengths, the things that aren't normally considered masculine, but yet men have the capability. There's a great book called Brain Rules, which I love. Dr. John Medina, great Washington State guy, by the way. One of the great people we have, the University of Washington, and he's a brilliant man, a delightful man. But in his book, I saw that they finally refuted the BS about women are too emotional, and they found out with all the studies of the brain that the reason that women seem more emotional is actually because their brains are better at remembering stuff, especially highly detailed stuff, than our brains. So if you take a man and a woman, average, put them in a gruesome crime scene, our brains are designed not to remember that so well, so that we're not going to have. So if you ask me 2 weeks later, hey, man, what was that crime scene like? I'll be like, oh, dude, it was rough. You ask the average woman what the crime scene was like, she is going to be visibly upset because her mind is going to show her that stuff again, and it's going to have such a reaction to her. And they found out that's why women seem more emotional, because they vividly remember stuff so much better than we do. For whatever reason, whether because we had to go hunting and we're the stupid ones going, you know what? Jimmy got crushed by that woolly mammoth. I don't remember that. Let's go back out and do it again. Maybe that's why we're not supposed to remember. I don't know. But so that was always, for years, it was like, she can't be in that position. She's too emotional. And we used to think it was, because she's less than, but it's no, we're the ones that are less than, which is why we don't have access to these emotional things, because we don't remember the vivid details. But it's there. We are just as emotional. And that's what they're finding out, is that maybe even men are less able to handle their emotions than women because of it. But we have a lot of emotions. We can basically be as emotional as anybody, but we're just not trained. We're not encouraged. And I think if you tell a dude, hey, man, would you like to be able to have a conversation with the women in your life and really be able to hold your own and not feel like, oh, my God, I'm an idiot, or I won't be able to handle this, and whatever, you just yes dear someone, because you, would you like to be able to defend yourself? Would you like to be able to articulate yourself in a way? Because I think there is this idea that women think that they're more socially adept, they are able to speak better, and therefore men will just go, whatever, mea culpa, not mea culpa, but just I surrender when it comes to, honey, we have to talk. And I think if you tell dudes, you can be just as good. Like, you really can be on par with the level that you're, that the women in your life are on when it comes to social communication and being able to have conversations. I think that would motivate men to get therapy. If you tell them there's a benefit here, you'll get some great tools. You'll be a much more well-rounded person, which then will make you more successful at your job. You won't be, you'll realize people who are charming are just people that have developed social skills, which you could do. And it's just tapping into your real emotions, being real with yourself, which then just gives you a superpower. That's how I sell it anyway. If anybody says, hey, I don't know. I'm like, yeah, well, and we're capable of it. We are really, we're capable of it. We really are.
Yeah, absolutely. I really want to thank you for speaking to young men. I feel like over this last decade, a lot of men have felt beaten down, and many of them are great men. Sure, there is the subset of terrible, violent, toxic masculinity, but then there's also a lot of men who, it's a cliche now, are playing video games in their basement, who don't have any power at all whatsoever, really, and hardly any agency over their life. And we kept hearing really discouraging rhetoric, I think, from the mainstream. And to have an encouraging, uplifting, empowering message coming from somebody with a voice is, man, I can't tell you how much I admire it, appreciate it, and how inspiring it is.
Oh, my pleasure. It's the least I can do. I haven't always been a voice that's contributed positivity. I sure as heck have done a lot of hurt. I've hurt a lot of people in my life, done a lot of damage in my life. So I'm happy that I can reverse that trend a bit and do something good. I hate that word good because the other side is evil. I'm not a big fan of good and evil. But yeah, I'm glad I'm doing something positive with this because it hasn't always been the case. Yeah, and it is tough. It feels like it's not toxic masculinity. It just feels like for some men that all masculinity is toxic. And that's what the world feels like. And that's hard because usually an advocate, it's got to be somebody on the other side because they'll just go, hey, if you're a man and you go, you know what? I think you guys are being mean to us. You're a man. Of course, you're going to say that. It always takes somebody from the side that's in power to actually stick up for somebody. And it's also hard to even say the side that's in power because people go, you guys are in power. But the idea that it has to be somebody from the other side, from a marginalized side or from any side that will go, no, you know what? They make a good point. I mean, that's how all stuff ends. That's how slavery ended. That's how women got to get more respect in the workplace. It was people who were on the other side that stood up and said, no, they make a good point. Don't dismiss them just because they're the ones bringing it up. And you're just go, of course you'd say that. You're one of them. But when somebody else says it, who's not one of them, it has more power. And so I think if we can get more women to really step up, and I think mothers are starting to do that when they see that their sons are being treated like crap and they're like, wait, this is not fair. What did he do to get? Then I think you're seeing a lot more women say, wait a minute, not all masculinity is toxic. And my son's really a great dude. Wait a minute. Why are you discounting him? And I think that is a thing that's really, I've had this argument with my girlfriend because she's a big feminist. And of course, she's right about a lot of things. It's not like everything is equal. But I always say to her, I said, look, you got to give some of us credit. And because sometimes she gets a little upset at all men. And I'm like, you have to give some of us credit because you would be nowhere if I didn't say, yeah, you're right. And she's like, what do you mean? I go, in the 1980s, I was in my 20s. And that's when women were like, hey, we want to do this and this. And then there were 40-year-old men who were like, that's preposterous. What are you talking about? And us 20-year-old dudes were like, no, they make a good point. And look at old man, especially guys in their 60s at the time. Look at old man. No, that's antiquated belief system. It makes no sense. We're going to stand up for these women who make, they're being reasonable. So I tell my girlfriend, we did that. You can't hate us all. If there were some good dudes that fought the good fight, and let's be honest, we were in power. There was no reason for us to surrender our power, except we just thought it was the right thing to do. And that, I think, is lost, that there were good men that stood up just like in the world of slavery, there were good white people that said, this is wrong and we've got to fix this. And I think that just gets lost sometimes, that like not everybody in that power group was a jerk. There were some really good people in those power groups that helped make things right. And sometimes the marginalized folks forget that. And I think that's what some of us men are feeling. I think that's what's led to a lot of this ridiculous thing where people go, as a white person, I feel like I'm getting treated. I understand why you're feeling that, but you've gone way too far to the extreme. Please, your life is still fine. But to their point, hey, how about a little appreciation for the fact that were some people that actually had your back and you're not acting like anybody had your back. And that's tough to hear sometimes for a lot of us dudes, especially when, like you said, Ryan, we feel like we have no power at all. We have nothing to offer. It's like we kick ass. And a lot of us are really good-hearted, really honorable people.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to remember, is that just because you can't generalize an entire group of any group of people, because there are different people. And that's what we forget, is we start comparing versus groups instead of people's hearts versus people's hearts. And I think that's a really lost art these days. So I think guys like us more easily adapt to that because we are open to discussing our feelings.
Yeah, and that's why I love behavioral science, because if you want to see somebody's heart, well, I got to go inside first. I got to make sure I'm seeing my heart. I got to make sure that I'm okay with me. And that's what's so great about behavioral science, because there are a lot of forces in society that don't want me to have that clarity, that want me to feel less than, because when I feel less than, then I'll buy things. It's a sad thing. Right now, the ugliest part of capitalism is this desire to ruin my life so they can make money. It's not what I think capitalism is supposed to be. It's everything has got good intentions. I love the idea of a free market. I love the idea that you can use your effort to make as much money as you want. But when something is taking advantage of the lessening of my life so that you can make money, and you're going, it's legal. No, that's not what any human wants. I'm sorry. Nobody's going to sign off on that. We may have accidentally been deluded into thinking this was, or maybe we turned around and didn't realize it was happening. But nobody wants you to destroy my life for profit. No, that's no decent human being on any side of the aisle is going to want that, especially if we're all trying to get along in a country. We just don't want that. And behavioral science is the way, and mental health is the way for each of us to get to that understanding on our own. It's hard to tell people, the masses, hey, you're being brainwashed. That's a hard message to give, but we can do it individually. Go person to person, and our sphere of influence with everybody around us, that we can make a change. We put our oxygen mask on and then we put theirs on. That we can do. I don't have to save the whole plane, maybe just a couple of people around me. And if everybody does, that's how change can be made. And that's why, Ryan and Sky, you guys, this is why this podcast is great, because that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Thanks. Man, I feel like we have so much that we could talk about, but we're getting to the end of our time today. Yeah.
I think this is the fastest hour I think we've ever.
It went by so fast. Yeah. I can't even believe it's already been that long. There's just so much information we could cover. And I used to listen to you for hours on the radio, so I could just listen to you talk and talk. It's great.
I'm happy to talk about mental health. Anytime you guys want, you let me know. I'll always clear room in my schedule to do this because I think it's a great topic. And I love to meet like-minded human beings. It makes me feel better about being on this planet. So my pleasure.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, BJ. This is an absolute pleasure. You're a wealth of knowledge and so fun to listen to. So truly, and thank you for the message that you're giving to people too. Really appreciate that. Yeah.
Awesome, guys. Well, that does it here for us at Hey Man, It's Okay, a men's mental health podcast. Please make sure to spread the word. Tell everybody about us. If you want to have a mental health conversation with us, just like BJ did, just let us know. Please comment, subscribe. All of our social media is at Hey Man, It's Okay. And from Sky, the regular guy, it's okay to not be okay.
Thank you so much, everybody.
Thanks, guys.